RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
My guest today works in one of the key areas of filmmaking, costume design. Jenny Bevan is one of the world's most sought-after designers and is at the top of her game with a mantelpiece loaded with many prestigious awards, including 3 Oscars and an OBE. Her part in the collaborative world of filmmaking is to use clothes to tell stories and to help the actors find their characters. It all started back in the 1970s when an old friend of Jenny's asked if she would like to help out finding some costumes for a leading actress on a film production. That actress turned out to be Dame Peggy Ashcroft, and they got on so well that Dame Peggy asked Jenny to accompany her to the film's location in Jaipur, where Merchant Ivory was producing the production. Jenny, seeing an opportunity to embrace a new world, jumped at it, and for little money, she got enthusiastically stuck in doing everything and anything. And so began what was to become the beginning of her creative path, and one that led to an astonishing film career, with productions from A Room of the View to Gosford Park and The King's Speech to Mad Max Fury Road, just a small sampling from the 46 films she has worked on since 1979. 2021 saw her receive her 3rd Oscar for Cruella, and in the recently released Mrs. Baxter Goes to Paris, Jenny had to recreate classic Christian Dior dresses, as no original patterns could be found, and she had to work from old photos and catwalk newsreels, along with the added pressure of her work having to be approved by the House of Dior. She passed with flying colours. We recorded our interview remotely with Jenny at her home in Peckham and me 125 miles away in Dorset. I started our conversation by asking Jenny what she was currently working on.
Well, it's a long story, but basically one of my housemates, or I like to say I live with, is a comedian called Joe Lycett.
Oh, yes.
And he was at university with my daughter and has become an incredibly good family friend, apart from it's been just fascinating watching his career. And he's a real man of many parts, not just a stand-up, but he does a lot of art and he does a lot of all sorts of things, including charity work. But he loves the idea of being a filmmaker, so he's been funding a couple of short films. He'd written it, he got a really great little team together, including some Birmingham young filmmakers, and it's a hilarious script, and it's a hilarious local comedian called Janice Connolly, who's absolutely brilliant. It'll only be about, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, but I have a feeling it'll be really good.
Oh, good.
But he's making it for himself, and then it'll go to festivals, and yes. I don't know, you know.
The usual with thing.
The usual thing. But it's just really for Joe, and I was terribly impressed watching him direct and watching
good.
Him handle the whole thing. So that's what that was about, and now I'm back.
I'll watch out for that. Looking back at your, I have to say, incredible substantial list of films since 1979. Mm-hmm. To date, I think it's 46 I counted.
Crikey Moses.
Well, including some of the ones that are still unreleased. I think
yes,
there are a couple
absolutely.
At the end.
Yeah.
And you seem to have worked every year without stopping. I was looking for major gaps. I couldn't really see any. So that's nearly 50 years of non-stop work. You don't seem to stop. Did that play havoc with your home life? I mean, you must have travelled a lot.
Yes, it did. This is not a great career for relationships, to be honest. I had a wonderful relationship, and I have got the most fantastic daughter, who's also going into the film industry. So,
she's a producer, isn't she, I think?
Yes, she is.
Caitlin.
It's after a Scottish Caitlin we met. But yes, she is. She's now part of Genesius Films, which is Debbie Gray's company,
right.
Who just did Good Luck to You, Leah Grand, which
right.
is a fantastic film. I mean, I had to work because I was sort of the breadwinner of our relationship, and
right.
you know, in those days, yes, it was reasonably well paid, but you basically took every job as it came. I mean, some things I did, I think I would never have thought I'd do, but you know, they often turned out really well. But I have worked fairly non-stop.
Well, that's great. Well, I want to wind back now, so I want to find out how your creative path started. So you were born just 4 years after the Second World War ended, so you're a kind of, I think they call them a baby boomer.
I call myself a war baby.
You're
but
a war
I know
baby.
I'm a little bit after it, but my mentality is war baby.
Yep.
Waste not, want not.
Now, your father, Peter, was a cellist with the Philharmonic Orchestra, and your mother, too, Molly, was a viola player. And I think she also played with the Philharmonia from time
to
time.
She did. She did.
And you had a younger sister, Hilly.
Yeah,
so the family, obviously, the house must have been very musical. So I assume that it was a comfortable sort of middle-class background. Would that be right?
Yes, in a way it was. I mean, musicians were very badly paid in the beginning of the 50s. So we went quite hard up, but they both had amazing aspirations for us in terms of, we didn't go out a lot. I mean, in those days you didn't, though. Going to the theatre was an absolute treat, or the ballet or whatever. But we did go to a lot of concerts and a lot of rehearsals when they couldn't afford babysitters.
So what would you say your earliest memories are?
Oh, the flat in Lexham Gardens. It was a basement flat with a wonderful sort of corridor in the basement in red lino. And if you turned the stools upside down, they made boats and you could sort of hotch them up and down. And I think we were always imaginative, you know.
So,
and
where was that exactly? Where?
Lexham Gardens, just off the Cromwell Road.
Oh, right, okay.
But it was not a smart area then.
Right.
You know, all those great big houses on Cromwell Road were all tons and tons of bedsits, and our house was tons of bedsits with students upstairs who were forever overflowing the bath, you know, which came straight down into our yard. But I can see that flat so clearly. My father had a little... He was a great hobby man too. He loved letterpress printing and was actually good at it. So at the back of the flat, there was a funny little room just beyond the bathroom, which was his little den with his Adana printing press.
Oh, really? How fascinating.
And also, he did really good photographs, and he used to develop them. And the most exciting thing ever, you know, is watching the image come up in the bath.
So it was a pretty diverse creative background, really, if he was into letterpress printing on an Adana, as well as playing music. So what sort of people drifted through the house?
Mainly musicians. Friends of my parents tended to be musicians of one sort or another. A lot of quartets were played in the big front room, which also doubled as a bedroom. I mean, we didn't have... There were two big rooms. One was my parents' bedroom, which was also like the sitting room. And then our sort of nursery, as it was called, was behind, which was also doubled as a playroom. And then downstairs, there was a room known as the warm, because it had a Courtier stove in it. And my mother had left a wall so we could draw on it. I mean, she was so enlightened. She was so enlightened.
So how old would you have been around this time? Are we talking 6, 7?
Well, I was born round the corner from there, and I think we left it when I was 11 and went over to Putney, because that was a rented flat that my mother had had when she was a student at the Royal College of Music.
Right.
Her father had got it for her. Not that he was rich, but, you know, somehow I guess it didn't cost a lot. And I think the rent went up substantially around about the early 60s. So we moved to Putney, to a little typical Edwardian sort of...
So by now, are you still in junior school?
I'm just moving to senior school. We went actually from Kensington. We went first to a school called the Chelsea Froebel School, which was that German system of play and make things. You kind of come out very well educated when you're about 7. And then I went on to Kensington High School, which was Girls' Day School Trust, before I moved to Putney High.
So you were pretty academic, would you say?
Because of the Froebel training, I was pretty good at writing and maths, because you play and you make like sweets and then you sell them in a shop you've also made. And so you're doing all that, but without really realising you're learning all about numbers.
Right.
It's a clever system. That's all I can say.
I know that your grandfather took you to the theatre and you sort of fell in love with that. So how did that your own world start to manifest itself?
Well, I think it was that outing to see Dorothy Tootin in Twelfth Night at, I think, the Old Witch, when I must have been 10 or 11. And he used to stay with us, and he always gave us sixpence if we could tell him where a quote from Shakespeare came from. And sixpence was a serious amount of money then. So, you know, you really tried to get it right. And we didn't have television. We were always encouraged to make things. We didn't have money for a lot of toys. So I remember making whole environments and endless dolls' houses out of boxes, and then the dolls themselves out of sticks, and wrapping them to make little figures. And I did a lot of painting and drawing and a lot of reading. I mean, I think, but that was more natural then. I remember going to a friend who had television, which was about 3 inches square, and thinking, what is the point? And making straight for their bookshelves, you know.
Yeah.
There just didn't seem to be any point at all in looking at this stupid thing in black and white. And,
well, I think most people then were getting their televisions on HP, weren't they?
Or
they
were
renting them. That was the thing.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So when did you start to get a sort of inkling to want to move on into and to study art more seriously? You eventually went to Central St Martin's to study theatre design.
How
did that come about?
School was fine. I can't blame it. And I absolutely loved English, because I found out later on everybody loved our English teacher, Miss Sackett. She just brought things to life and loved Shakespeare and definitely made me love Shakespeare and John Donne and all that and poetry. And she was brilliant. So that side was fine. But the rest I found deeply boring. But I discovered there was a course at Morley College. By this time, I knew theatre was where I was headed. And in those days, you could go to the Old Vic and stand in the Gods for 2 shillings. And you could go to the Old Witch and see the Royal Shakespeare Company for equally tiny amounts of money. And my mother had died by then. She died in the early 60s. But my father was very encouraging of this. So I'm afraid I used to skip school on a Thursday afternoon and go to matinees at the Old Vic. And,
well, that's great.
Well, obviously, did me no harm whatsoever. And Morley College did this stage management course, and my friend Georgina was also very keen, so we went along. And they, in those days, so we're talking about 66, had an amazing opera group and theatre company, which really nourished young opera singers, you know. It was a great place to have a go. The first one I remember was The Turn of the Screw.
Oh, yes, Benjamin Britten, that one.
Oh, it absolutely hit me, and I can sing you every note of that even now. And then the next one we did was Pelléas and Mélisande, which is also an extraordinary opera, you know, for a basically student opera company to do.
Yes.
And we stage managed and did props, and I was just loving every single minute of it. And the opera house had a scheme for stage managers, I think in the London Opera Centre that was along Commercial Road, no longer there, of course. And I sort of thought about that, and then something clicked in my brain that it might be better to go to art school, by which time it was quite late, but I managed to get a place at Bath Academy of Art.
Right.
Which was my first sort of time away from home, going to a college away, you know, not being at home, and I was pretty miserable, but I did make some good friends, and once I got the hang of being...
This is a sort of foundation course.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, foundation, pre-diploma.
Yeah.
While I was there, I was listening to Kaleidoscope on Radio 4.
Yes, yes, I remember Kaleidoscope.
And, wasn't it wonderful?
Yes.
And they were talking about a collaboration between the Central School of Art and Design and the Young Vic, and how it was at the Jeanette Cochrane Theatre, I think. I can't remember what the play was, but I thought, that sounds amazing. I think I'll apply for that. So I applied to Central for my 3-year, you know, course in theatre design and got in. And that had the most amazing time with Ralph Coltire's department.
Of course, yes, I know.
I mean, he certainly was, along
with Tim O'Brien, who sadly died recently.
Oh, did Tim die?
Yes.
I mean, well, they're all of an age, aren't
they? I know.
I mean, Ralph.
Well, I know Ralph was a great friend of Tim. He would often come to meetings, Ralph, when he was quite old.
Yes.
With his leather jacket, always.
Oh, the leather jacket, which was there from 19... What did I go there? 68 or 69? He had a leather jacket. It could well have been the same one.
I think it probably was a soft brown leather jacket. One.
Just gorgeous. How wonderful. He was at Cosprop doing a play at Watford, doing costumes about, gosh, 10 years ago. And he was in the reception area there. Both of us got into terrible trouble for talking too much and not doing any work. We were both chastised by our assistants, but I thought it was so brilliant to see him. Briefly, to finish the Ralph story,
yes,
of course,
yes.
I mean, theatre was all I wanted to do
in
set design, because that's what he did, and I was in awe of him, and spent 3 years there with him.
That must have been fantastic. So let's move on to leaving Central and ending up with Dame Peggy Ashcroft. This is the story that really opens up your path, doesn't it?
It does.
So could you tell that story?
I can tell you that story. So when I was very little, my mother had sent me to this dance. Well, it wasn't dance. It was Dalcroze Eurythmics. It's a music and movement study, a French thing with basically you're listening to the time of the music and you're doing four with your hands and three with your feet and listening to something in 5/5. It's a brilliant mind test. And I met a boy called Nick Young. And Nick Young ended up on the South Bank show as a commissioning editor via Oxford, and well, he was at the Lycée Westminster in Oxford. At right. Westminster, he had met a boy called Richard McCrory. They were study mates. Mm-hmm. And Richard's father had written a book called Signal Catastrophe about the disastrous British involvement in the First Afghan War and their, you know, subsequent annihilation in the Khyber Pass, and wanted to make it into a film. And someone had said to Richard's father, oh, you should meet Merchant Ivory. They're the people, you know, to make a film like that. Yeah. So he had managed to meet them. He'd invited them down to his house in Sussex. But actually, Richard, who was into making home movies on a Super 8 cine camera, was much more interesting to Jim and Ismail than poor Richard's father. So they spent the whole time making crazy films. But it meant that when they were in London or doing anything in England, Richard would get involved to help, no pay, and Nick would too. And if they needed a bit of extra help, I would pitch along. So I kind of got to know them. Then when Nick was at the South Bank show, he commissioned Hullabaloo over Bonnie and George's Pictures, yes, from Merchant Ivory, which is, yep, basically a legendary collection of miniature paintings, has appeared in Jodhpur, Rajasthan, or in some Maharaja's palace, and three art collectors are desperate to get it, the English one being Dame Peggy Ashcroft. So I got rung up, of course. Jenny, could you go and see Dame Peggy, she needs some clothes, you know, for this part. She's an eccentric English art collector travelling overland with her young, possibly gay companion. I thought, fine. And no money. So it's her wardrobe or my wardrobe or anything we can borrow off John Bright. And I really loved her. She had a wonderful sort of rambly house in Hampstead. And, you know, we put together a sort of interesting group of clothes. And on the second visit, she said, my dear, we're getting along quite well. I'm a little concerned about going to India. This is pre-Jewel in the Crown and Passage to India. She said, I'm a little concerned and I'm a little worried, and they've offered me a first-class air ticket. If I change it for two economies, will you come with me? Well, I didn't need a second. So then next thing, I was on a plane to India with Dame Peggy Ashcroft, and we ended up in Jodhpur, Rajasthan, in this fabulous palace. And they were, I mean, Ismail and Jim knew I was coming, but they were a little surprised to see me. Anyway, I shared a room with Peggy. We looked after each other, but, you know, I looked after also her clothes and her wig and everything else that needed doing. And then I ended up being in the film. I did crowd collecting, which was bunches of tourists persuading them to come and watch a show, because that was part of the story and being filmed. And I did the props, and I had to make a Father Christmas costume. And so I literally became part of the family, because I was happy to have a go at anything, really. But they saw me as a costume designer. So that's how that changed, really.
Well, you also mentioned a name just now that I wanted to come to, and that was John Bright.
Ah, yes.
Who I think you've referred to him as teacher, mentor, and a, yep, historian. Can you talk a little about him? Because I think you have worked with him quite a lot subsequently after that experience. Talk about John.
I first met John when I was at the Welsh Theatre Company, where I went after Central. I went on it was called an Arts Council trainee designer scheme, which sadly is no longer done, but it was wonderful. And they placed you in a theatre as an assistant. The idea was that you could design one show, but in the Welsh Theatre Company, I designed every other show, I think. And we did a thing called Nightmare Abbey, and it was sort of 1820s, vaguely. And one of the people working there was actually a very well-known maker, costume maker, but she'd married one of the directors of the Welsh Theatre Company. And she said to me, I needed a black suit, which I couldn't just create any other way. She said, you must go and see my friend John Bright at Cosprop. So I did, and that was the first time I met him. And he had the very first Cosprop in Camden Town, and his first thing to me was, so what date is it? Of course, I hadn't a clue. I just wanted something long, black and Victorian for a very tall actor. Anyway, he kind of got over the fact that I was obviously totally ignorant and hopeless. So the second time I meet him is with Dame Peggy, because she'd worn a mat from Cosprop in something and thought it'd be perfect for Hullabaloo. So I trolled back at there again. And then I met him really properly on The Europeans, which was a film I was assistant on, again, Merchant Ivory. Mm. And Judy Moorcroft designed it, and I assisted her. And I just realised what a complete genius he is, and the most knowledgeable person about really period clothing and the way it develops and what it's made of and how it works and everything about it. And he actually came out. We were shooting a big scene in Boston and he came out. And at that time, I just thought he was a complete enigma. I couldn't make him out. I knew he was an incredibly nice person and incredibly kind and so knowledgeable. But I was so in awe of him, I think, that I couldn't kind of fathom him. He's now one of my best friends in the world and actually coming to dinner on Thursday. We've obviously all missed each other's birthdays, so we're having a day elder day party.
Right. So the film you're talking about just now, I think, is The Europeans of 1979. That's the early one, isn't it? Yes.
Yes. And I was the assistant, Judy's assistant.
Right.
And then The Bostonians was two films later.
Yes.
And Judy was supposed to do that, but actually ended up doing David Lean's Passage to India with Dame Peggy Ashcroft.
Right.
And it was a little bit last minute, I think, that she said she wanted to do that, not Bostonians. And Ismail literally turned around to me in his beautiful Indian accent, "Jenny, you will do it." And John couldn't have been more wonderful. We were doing it all out of Cosprop because that's the best stock in the world for 1870s.
Yes.
Cosprop is a very fine costume house.
Yes, I looked at the website and I read a bit of the history and I can see why he's so highly rated. He really does know his stuff.
God, he knows it. But he's also a great filmmaker and storyteller, you know. But on The Bostonians, we started with a big party scene again. They always look great. In Newport, Rhode Island, and it did look amazing. You know, it would do. I mean, unless you got it terribly wrong, because that is a very flamboyant period and it's very beautiful. And people would just kept coming up to me and saying, "Jenny, it looks just fabulous, you know. Gee, the costumes." And I thought, well, yeah, but I think we did this together. And I remember saying to John, you know, I think we should share a credit. I wasn't sure if he'd want to, because if you're actually running a costume house, I didn't know whether he'd want to be credited, you know, just in case people thought. But he was very pleased. And that started our, I think it's about 12 films. You've probably got more details than I've got, working together.
I think it's six, actually.
Six?
Well, you've got The Bostonians. That's the first one, I think.
Then Room you've got the View.
Room with a View, where you shared an Oscar together.
Yep.
And then you've got The Deceivers.
Yes.
And then
Remains
you've got
the
Howard's
Day.
End.
Howard's End.
And Remains
Jefferson
of the Day.
Jefferson in Paris.
Jefferson in Paris.
Sense and Sensibility. Sensibility. And...
I think that's it.
Oh, that might be it. Yeah.
So it's seven.
Oh, sorry.
I missed one.
Seven.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
There you go.
Seven.
It's not
pretty,
bad, is it?
That's good.
Oh, God, it was so lovely. We used to, Cosprop was shut at really 5:30, but sort of by 5:45. I would put the kettle on. We'd have a nice cup of tea and do our work. Then start doing, for a couple of hours, we'd work on whatever, like, on Room with a View or whatever, you know, putting stuff on the stand, searching around for fabrics, seeing what... We were our own assistants too. We didn't seem to have assistants in those days or supervisors. It was all very DIY.
And I think with Merchant Ivory, if I remember rightly, a long time ago, I saw a documentary about them, that Ishmael was quite tough on the money.
Yes, I would say that was an understatement, actually. Jenny, why do I have to pay you? I am giving you this wonderful work. Yes, he didn't quite like parting with the money, which he did take a lot of trouble getting. I mean, he used to sit on people's doorsteps to get money to make the films. Absolutely.
I think, there's no doubt about it, that that whole period of you working on those films really must have been the foundation for your fantastic ability to work on anything, period. You always make it wonderfully. So I think maybe not getting as much money as you would like must have paid back in bucket loads.
Absolutely. And I'm still here. Yes.
Move. I wanted to know a little bit, particularly for people listening that are in other disciplines and they don't quite understand how the costume designer fits into the overall scheme of things and how you work collaboratively with other departments. If we could start from the beginning, I assume that you always start with the script. Your agent will send you a script or whatever to see whether you're interested.
I get sent a script. I read it. If I'm interested, I'll get to meet the director. And then if we get on and he likes what I do, I'll be offered the job. And from that moment on, I'm part of the team that is making this film. And it is totally teamwork. And my job is storytelling the clothes to support the actor in the story they are telling. And again, it's teamwork. So that's my feeling. I never do a drawing. A, I can't draw and I think it's very two-dimensional. I tend to put my ideas together in mood boards.
Right.
or working onto a stand, either with just draping fabric or existing clothes of your period, like from Cosprop. You know, I do endless stands and photograph them and then send them to the director to make sure we're on the same page. And then the next bit is the fitting. But in the meantime, we've probably had a production meeting, or I've met with the DOP and the production designer, and we've all looked at each other's colours and, you know, discussed the mood of the film or or whatever. There's been a lot of creative discussion, and I've done my mood boards and what have you, however I'm thinking of doing it.
You're brought in really very early on, same time as the DP and the production designer?
Normally after the production designer. The production designer comes on very early, and I think the DOP often a little bit later. I think that's a bit variable. Actually, I'm not entirely sure. I know I should know after however many films I've done, but no, probably the DOP is on very early because that will be the direct, the eyes of the the film.
The vision.
And then I come on a bit later. Problem often is they then cast it very late, so however on top of it I feel I am, until you've actually got the act in the clothes in the sitting room.
Yeah,
you don't know whether it's going to work or not.
Exactly, and I'm interested to know you're really up close and personal to these often mega stars. And,
and in a
very vulnerable state too, I should think. And actors are obviously all different. They have different ways of getting to find their character. Some want to be in their character already, and they want to behave in their character throughout the process of filmmaking, which must be, I'm sure, very difficult, particularly if they're method actors. Have you had that sort of relationship?
I've been incredibly lucky. I think I'm no threat to them. I mean, you must know what I look like.
Yes,
short,
of course.
Fat and Welsh, you know. not clothes to me are not interesting in themselves.
Right.
I tend to wear a variety of workwear.
Yes.
Smarter or less smart, depending. So I'm no threat, but I obviously know they know what I can do. So my relationship with them is normally really good.
Mm-hmm.
Even the ones who are apparently difficult, they often actually aren't. But as you say, they are fragile and vulnerable.
Yes.
And one does end up as a therapist and a mother and various, you know, definitely nurturing role, I think, as we find the look, the character, which is incredibly exciting, actually, watching them transform in front of your eyes into somebody else. And the most wonderful thing is when they actually look at themselves in the mirror and say, now I know who I am. And then I feel, that's why I do this job. It's so wonderful. All that process sort of happens, and you photograph it all the time, and obviously on iPhones it's so easy now.
Yes.
Used to do it, have to run down to Snappy Snaps, have them develop, come back, cut them out, stick them down, you know, send them off by pigeon post or whatever. I mean, life is in many ways so much easier.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The other terrible thing is that they can change the schedule, you know, at a 2-minute notice, because all you do is send out an email. But from my point of view, a research and sharing of information has become hugely easier.
Yes, I mean, that's true. It always, there's an upside and a downside. I think many editors and cinematographers feel that because everything is now visible instantly on a screen, you know, digitally, people can interfere more, you know, whereas before you'd have to wait for dailies, you know. And so you've got your actor, and you're building his character with him or her. Then they find that thing. Whether it's quite often with an actor, I think it can be a small thing, can't it? A hat or
a hat, shoes.
Yes.
I mean, shoes are terribly important, because you know what it's like if you don't have comfortable feet.
Yes.
And the height of the heel can make such a difference to how you feel in yourself. I remember even just a couple of inches, you know, would just make you feel elevated and sort of smarter and sort of stronger. It can be anything, really.
Because you have done so many historic films, all that research you're talking about, how far do you go? I say that because Anthony Powell, who I know you knew very well, who also sadly died last year, which is awful, he said to me in an interview I did with him a long time ago that it goes right down to the underwear.
Oh, yes. Well, it has to, because that's the foundation of the shapes often. So if you put someone into you know, an Edwardian or Victorian suit or dress without proper corsetry,
yes.
It looks terrible
in
a modern floppy bra. And, you know, so, yes, it's terribly important.
Mm.
And even with Dior, which I've done recently.
Yes, I want to talk about that later.
That's, yeah, yes. the correct, because he used corsetry inside the frocks. And it just sharpens and just makes the right shape. So you absolutely need the right. And even with petticoats, I mean, you have to use proper cotton and not, or silk, and not sort of polyester. It just won't do the same things.
Yes.
And also, the modern fabrics, they quite often get very static,
yes.
Which is a kind of disaster.
Get electrocuted.
Yes, and everything wraps around. You know how
yes.
when you wear some, well, you won't probably have worn a skirt that sort of wraps itself around your knees because
yes.
it's full of static. But there's so many things, but it's always worth making sure the underneath is right, and then the top layer will look. And then nobody worries about it.
Yes.
People who try and do this sort of making it, giving it a modern twist, I mean, it can't, I say it can work, I can't remember when I've ever seen it work, but basically, if you get it right, nobody worries about it and they listen to the story.
Because of the nature of what you're doing, presumably you're one of the first ones to be on set, along with makeup, I guess. You,
yes.
You have to be dressed.
Indeed they do. It's a very long day. But once the costume is established, there's a crew to look after that. Now, in the days of
yes.
Merchant Ivory, there wasn't really. We Italian section of a room with a view had four of us.
Really?
And they were quite big crowds. Sally Turner, still a dear friend, also coming on Thursday, looked after all the principals, which involved stiff collars, corsets, all the thing of doing it, boots and all that stuff. Myself, pregnant at the time, William Pierce and an Italian woman called Elena Puliti dressed and undressed all the crowds. So how we didn't die, I can't imagine. But that's what we did then. Now you'd have had a team of 20.
So is that your normal now these days? Do you have a regular team that you work with?
I
generally
have a few regular teams, which I get if I can. I mean, two particular supervisors in England I love, and then there's a few others I think are great but haven't worked with as much. And I have a fantastic team in Prague, actually, when I was there last time. Yes, I definitely have teams I choose to work with, if
yes.
possible.
I want to talk a little bit about your house, because I've seen photographs of you, which, you know, where you're sitting now, probably.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes,
the
I
one,
am
the
sitting
one,
in it, yeah.
The ones that I've seen are with a piano in the background. Do you play the piano?
Sadly not. I'm a very bad cellist, not a pianist.
Right.
But that was my grandmother's piano,
ah.
my father's mother, which
yes.
she bought in 1936 in Chapels in Bond Street. She was a pianist for silent cinema in Cardiff.
Oh, wow.
So it's got
a bit of history to it.
It's got a lot of history, yeah.
yeah
it's
yeah.
a lovely little piano. And lots of people do play it, but not me.
What I wanted to talk about the house, because I read little bits about it, and it's in Peckham in South East London,
it is.
Isn't it? And it's
yep.
a large house, and you've got quite a lot of people living there with you. And I know that you
yep.
use it quite often as a kind of base camp for work. You work from there quite a lot if it's in the UK.
I have to say, that's not quite true
no.
About the work. We had to do Furiosa, the thing I've just come back
oh,
from Australia.
Oh, the Mad Max, the new one.
Yeah.
Yes.
We started because basically we couldn't go to Australia. So Lauren, my wonderful associate costume designer from Manchester, would come down for 3 or 4 days a week. And we worked out of the sitting room at the beginning because, to be honest, we couldn't quite work out. It's really strange when you've got a crew, big crew in Sydney.
Yes.
And there's two of us here. And I knew team out there. Well, I knew Mel, the supervisor, who's absolutely fantastic. She'd done Fury Road. So there's a really good relationship. And we were using quite a lot of, actually, I probably shouldn't say this.
What?
I mean, there's no harm in saying that, yes, we did start here in the sitting room. And in the end, it just got too much. And we managed to rent a little studio around the corner in a sort of great building, actually, that is out to rent to artists and what have you. So that was a relief. But yes, I mean, I do start a lot. I'm sitting at the moment in my library, and that's where I will sort of start pulling images. And I've got lots of books and obviously the internet. But the house is big old Victorian house, and it is normally stuffed with the poor and needy of the parish.
Yeah.
But
is that because you think with film it's such a specific place to work? It's like a little community that comes together for the duration of the film. Everyone knows everyone, and then they all depart, and you might not see them for years or months.
No, it's slightly different. Sometimes people who live out of town and need a room because we're prepping in London do come.
Yeah.
But normally it's a very mixed bunch. Over the years, my daughter went to Manchester University and made the amazing group of friends who are still tremendous friends, many of whom lived here in the house.
Right.
Many of my assistants have also lived here in the house until they've, you know, had enough money to go and do, get their own places or whatever. At the moment, I've got a location manager who's a friend of my daughter's. Well, that's a fabulous thing because he's terribly tidy and very good at looking after properties. I've got Joe's producer and his wife who've actually moved to Dorset, but they need somewhere several days a week in London, and Paul may need more, but so they're sort of coming and go. I've got Alex Lawther, who's now moved to France, who comes and goes in the attic. Joe's in the basement, that's a proper flat. Who else have I got? And I've still got a spare room for a friend, like Mrs. Norris in Mansfield Park.
It sounds very like a very lively household. I'm sure it's never a dull moment.
There's never a dull moment here, but I do have a little area where I can just retreat if needed. But I think it's a bit of a family thing. My father's mother, the pianist, moved to London when my father got a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Music. And apparently the family said, "Now, just be sensible, dear, get, you know, more flat." So she got the biggest house she could find in Kilburn and filled it with musicians and artists and what have yous.
Right.
And I feel it's just part of what we do, Bevans, you know. We love people.
Let's go back to Mad Max Fury Road, because that for you was a major departure, really. I think you'd only done one film that I could vaguely connect with it, and that was a sci-fi film, Life.
Oh, Life was after Mad Max.
I know it was after. But Mad Max was the first, wasn't it? It was the first. So suddenly you were given a completely different area to work in. And I think looking at the film and looking at the story, you kind of brought a kind of punk, goth and heavy metal feel to complement the, you know, the crazy cars and the whole mood of the film. What was it like to go suddenly from all of those, not only costume genres, but period pieces in the 1930s and 40s, to suddenly be in this strange world?
I was so thrilled. In a way, I'd always sort of thought I ought to start breaking out a bit. And it was through Ian Smith. I'd done Alexandra for him, which, again, I'd taken over. I'm quite a rescue mission person. And I'd taken over Alexandra quite late. So he knew I was good with big films in the desert for quite a long time. And I think he just thought I'd get on with George. So I got flown out to Sydney and met George, who's the most delightful man on earth. But he's quite hard to get to work out how it's going to work with him, because in my mind, George is an auteur of the, I mean, he thinks up the films, they're completely in his head, he works them out. You can add to his vision, but his vision is his vision, and that's what you are making.
Right.
It was a lovely meeting. He was in the middle of Happy Feet, a film about penguins, as you do. And I spent a week in Sydney in the office and working with various people there, like Nico, who's one of the writers, just getting the whole hang of it and seeing what they'd done, because they tried to make Fury Road several times with Norma Morrisseau, but Norma by that time was actually quite ill, although she wasn't saying anything about that, but she was getting on a bit and did not want to spend a year of her life in Namibia again. Nothing against Namibia, but it's, you know, a long way from home. So I saw what she'd done and, you know, looked at bits and bobs, and what I felt was I thought too S&M, too like Road Warrior, which had again been made 30 years before. So I felt that it needed to be gutsier. And George was happy with that. And I felt also all these war boys needed, I mean, they have nothing. They don't have a home or anything. So they must have pockets to keep whatever it is they need in. Otherwise, and that gives a nice sort of chunkiness to them. So they were more, they were just, as you said, a bit more punky. But of course, huge amounts of them is the makeup, Leslie Vanderbilt. And so working closely with her was, and she has done, I mean, she's known George Miller since they were both, I think she was 15 when she first met him. So, and she's almost part of his family. It was brilliant because she could explain some of the things I couldn't sort of quite understand about how George worked. And she's been absolutely fantastic on Furiosa as well. She's an amazing makeup artist and a really good friend. So,
And of course, that was for Mad Max. That was your second Academy Award, wasn't it?
It was indeed.
So that must have been quite a thrill.
but...
Yes, that was hilarious. You know, Room with a View and Mad Max. I was very pleased with
yes,
that.
Yes, I mean, what contrast.
Okay, yeah. But it was tough, but it's storytelling. So once you get the hang of it, it's actually exactly the same problem as if I was doing any film.
And the one after, Furiosa, which...
Yeah.
Has it completed yet? Is it?
Just about, yeah. Just. No, it has. Just
so
about.
You were over in Australia for that as well?
Yep. I've been there since January.
Because you still had your Australian address at the bottom of your...
Oh, God, yes. I must take that off. Yeah, sorry. Yes, I have, yeah.
I thought, oh, I'm going to have to work out the time zones.
No.
And then, last year, you, of course, got your third Academy Award for Cruella.
Yeah.
And, of course, dear old Anthony Powell did the earlier ones.
He did indeed, yes, he did.
And, of course, the thing about this film, I think, that captured so many people's imagination was that moment when Emma Stone arrives at a party with a white hooded outfit and she strikes a match and drops it onto her cape and then it burns up into a...
Yeah.
And turns into this amazing red dress. Now, I know that CGI was the main culprit to make that happen, but what influence did you have over that revealing of the dress itself? Did you sit down with the CGI department and work through the best way that how it should be revealed?
To some extent, yes. I mean, it's in the script what happens. And at one point, they had it going from the white cape into a red dress and into that changed into a yellow dress. And I said, I think that's one too many. You know, I don't think you need to do that. But what's lovely is people often ask me, how did you do it? And the CGI was so good.
Yes.
I mean, absolutely stunning, I thought, that, you know, everybody thinks it was for real. So I think
I'm sure.
But obviously, we wouldn't do that to Emma Stone. She's far too nice. And the red dress underneath, I hope you realise, is the red dress she sees in Artie's store, vintage store.
Yes.
And I made sure it had a very long sort of big stole with it so you could believe that there was enough fabric to do something with.
Right.
You know, I have to have a reality in everything I do that you, however bonkers it is, you can believe it or there's a reason for it.
Yes.
And then I think an audience accepts it more. So that's where the dress fabric came from. And then the most extraordinary maker called Ian Wallace, who was part of our team on Cruella. We had five amazing cutters, all with very different skills. And so Ian did all the sort of, I would say, tailored but organic tailored costumes. And Dominic Young did the tailored costumes. And Jane Lord did the Baroness. And Kirsten Fletcher did the photo bomb sort of outrageous. And Jeff Slack did more of the actual, the fashion show. So it was a very, very wonderful team. Ian Wallace actually made that dress because he'd always wanted to make a Charles James tree dress. And this seemed the perfect opportunity for it. So off he went, twisting, you know, strips of fabric round this thing. But also to show that it was a really weird deconstructed dress and very different to what the Baroness was doing. There was a whole, you know, you just start telling the stories and the design becomes, I don't say obvious, but it becomes clearer.
Sure. I just missed out that in 2017 you got yourself an OBE, which is very nice for you. And,
very nice.
And now that you have 3 Oscars, you're connected with Anthony Powell, who had 3 Oscars, and Sandy Powell, who
has got three Oscars. So, absolutely.
So all you've got to beat now is Edith Head, who had 8 Academy Awards.
Yes. I don't think I'll be doing that. I don't think any of us will.
How on earth did you get 8?
Because in those days she only did the principals.
Right.
I mean, she wouldn't have touched the crowds. Whereas these days we do
everything.
At least the look of everything.
Yeah.
And are very involved normally in the crowds because they set the tone. And if they don't look right, you know. But in those days, a whole sort of different set of people did the extras, the crowds. And so she could probably do 2 or 3 films at once.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
I mean, I'm not 100% sure how many she'd have done at once, but it was a totally different world. Yes. Yeah.
Well, talking of worlds, the world that I think perfectly suited for you is Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, because it's not only an actress who is marvellous, but a good friend of yours.
Yes.
But the subject matter, of course, is completely you, isn't it? I mean, really.
Yes, I suppose it was, in a way.
Well, the story, it's a very charming story about a sort of Is she a cleaner?
She's a cleaner. She's a Mrs. Mop,
loves dresses and becomes slightly besotted by Dior and wants to buy a dress and goes to Paris to buy it. It was a Paul Gallico short story, wasn't it?
It was a novella.
He wrote four of those, four different stories. She travels different places. But this one is lovely and it's beautifully shot, I must say. Really beautifully shot. And I know that from an interview that I did the other day, that you were not in the interview, by the way, so they could talk about you, actually. They were saying that you had, in fact, you know, gave them some very good advice about London of the 50s and the feel, look and colour. And likewise, you had a view on the look of Paris, that it would be sharper and you know, cleaner than, you know, the sort of muddiness or the greyness of London, which indeed London was at that time.
It was.
And they seem to have captured that really very beautifully. And Leslie Manville is so... She's so lovable in this film, as she always is in most things. Well, I say most
things. Except Phantom Thread. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny that she should have made two films of a sort of similar nature, but with totally different character, of course. So how was that film? I'd love to know how you got involved. And I think it's just out, isn't it? It's just out now.
It's out. It's out. It's out. And it's doing really well for a very low budget film, which I think... whoever made it, Focus, Lionsgate, I get ever so confused.
Oh, you mean,
are very pleased with it. And so they are actually giving it some, you know, distribution money and all that.
And that period is very fashionable, isn't it, at the moment?
It seems to
There's a Bill Nye film
Living, absolutely. That looks really good. High on the list.
Very nice moments in the film, that's for sure. Very much that 50s... mid to late 50s period.
Which I remember.
Me too.
I was 7 in 57, obviously. So as you get older, your memory of the earlier part of your life, like I said, I can see Lexham Gardens. I was living in Lexham Gardens. I can tell you all about the carpet and the banister that went down to the basement with its iron curlicues underneath. And we used to slide down the banisters. God knows why I didn't get killed. I mean, it was just the weirdest basement and semi-basement flat. Well, the ground floor and basement. So I can see it. And I can see the people who came. And I can see looking out into the street. So I knew those people.
Mm.
I mean, I didn't know Mrs. Harris herself, but, you know, I knew people like her.
Of course, she had that, you know, those sort of things that you put on your head. I forgot what they're called.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just a scarf. Just to keep your hair in place. And then she had her hat for Best, you know. And so nobody had many clothes in those days.
I don't know how early that... Is that late 50s?
57.
Okay.
57,
I was thinking earlier, of course, there was still, you know, after the war, there was still rationing went on to 1956 or something.
Something like that. I do remember vaguely ration cards, and I do certainly remember food. It was fairly basic. And then we would get parcels from Australia because my parents had been there, and, you know, dried fruit and exciting... just exciting tin pineapple and things.
Yes.
And there was great excitement about this when it arrived. So, but having a new dress or new shoes was a major and very thrilling event. So that was sort of made my life on a very small budget easier because you didn't, you know, she didn't need huge amounts of clothes. You just needed a natural change in selection.
And now tell me, there's also in the film, of course, you're making, you know, copies of Dior.
Yeah.
And I know you had access to plans and drawings and so forth, but they had to be approved by Dior, didn't they? Was that a bit nerve-wracking?
I decided I'd better have something in my contract to say, because I think the deal was, eventually, that they would pay for promoting the film, but only if they approved of it. And I thought, well, you know, if they don't approve of what I'm doing, I'm going to be in trouble. So I made them put a clause in the contract to say it wasn't my fault, basically, it wrong. But, I mean, I was hired under the assumption, told to me by the director, that I would be doing the regular clothes and Dior would be doing all the Dior stuff, including if I wanted something made for Madame Colbert, for instance, they would do that in your dreams. I don't know where that came from. So I went to the archives and had a wonderful afternoon. They are very, absolutely lovely and incredibly helpful. And they don't have much from the 50s because at that time they didn't see any need to keep it. You know, it wasn't So they made their collection, they sold it, they moved on to the next. So there's very little in the archives of our date, or even pre our date.
Mm-hmm.
We were sitting around the table after, and there was sort of silence, and I piped up and I said, you know, thank you so much for this most fantastic afternoon. I've absolutely loved it. And it's just wonderful that we'll be working together and that you will be doing, you know, the deal part. And four horrified faces looked over the table at me and just went, no. And I thought, okay, so I'm not even going to dare to turn to my left where two producers and a director are sitting. I looked firmly forward and said, okay, right. I don't know quite how many dresses we will, but gowns we will be reproducing. And they obviously at that point seemed to think they had nothing they could offer me or money. I said, I do know people who can do this. Obviously, John Bright at Cosbrook,
yes,
and
yes.
Jane Law, who made the Baroness and Cruella.
Right.
I said, but it will cost a lot of money. Mm. I mean, nothing to a Dior.
No.
But, you know, you're talking good fabric,
mm.
very good cutting, and expensive people who mm. also totally understand the, as we were talking before, the inners of mm. them, the mm. the way he made his, the little corset, and then the way he made the petticoat to give the shape and all that stuff. Anyway, I knew we were on a ridiculously small budget anyhow, but I mean, and then I discovered after that they had to approve it or they wouldn't. And okay, maybe. But then, see, Leslie Manville was involved. And I could not let her down.
She was a minor producer in that as well.
Yeah, she certainly got that credit. I don't know quite. I never quite understand what really means in terms of influence.
She said in an interview, it's not like I was going out to get any money because I wouldn't know how to do that anyway.
I mean, it was very, very tough. And we were in Budapest, which was locked down, of course.
Yes.
Budapest is very good at being Paris.
Yes. It,
the architecture is very wonderfully similar.
Beautiful, isn't it? Yes.
It's a beautiful city. And we had a good little crew, but again, not wildly experienced. The woman who looked after Leslie, Esther, was good, standby. But they were terribly nice. They needed us there all the time. It wasn't like me and Lauren, my wonderful English associate designer who has been with me also on Furiosa and Whitebird. But it was tough. Everything was slightly against us. But
How long were you there for? What was the duration of the shoot?
I think it was just under 4 months in
the
end.
Oh, really? That's quite, yes.
Yeah. I did force them because Shoka, our local Hungarian supervisor, said she really didn't have anyone to do the crowds. You know, that sort of person who does all the fittings and make sure it all looks right. So I did sort of force them to let me have two people from England who were brilliant, Paul Yowell and Sarah Twybee. That meant we're on astonishingly little stock. I think they gave all the different crowds a really great look, including, of course, the clientele at the Dior show,
yes.
who, you know, I just think look amazing because there's loads of research. I mean, just go onto YouTube and you can virtually see that show.
Really?
Yeah, it's all there. But then recreating it on a very low budget is tough with Hungarian producers who, a bit like Ismail, couldn't quite understand why they had to spend any money.
Oh dear.
It's a sort of curious one, that. So things just
well, you pull, you pulled it off in the end. That's the main thing.
Yes, I mean, thank you, my crew, my team, those actors were brilliantly cast.
Yes.
And Felix, the cameraman, as you said, beautifully
yes,
shot.
Yes, it is. It's very
my
beautifully shot.
My God, he was good. And yes. he was Leslie's idea.
Right.
She'd worked with him and thought he was really good. And I must say, I thought he was fantastic. And they did have, it looked like a really great camera crew in Budapest.
Yes.
Really great.
Looking at your 46 films, I think it is, as I was telling you at the beginning, there are only two female directors. Did you know that?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Caroline Thompson, sorry.
Black Beauty.
And Amma Asante.
Oh, Amma Asante, yeah.
Those are the only two females I could find in the list.
Yeah.
And it sort of says quite a lot about the film industry. I know it's changing, but it's quite astonishing, isn't it, really?
It is changing. I don't find it astonishing because coming from the 50s and that totally male-orientated society, I'm glad it's changing because I actually think I love female first assistants. We had one on Mrs. Harris, Hungarian woman, who's, I always called Juicy because her name was J-U-C-I, who I thought was great. I just take it of that thing of change.
And yes.
People get ever so angry about it, but it's like everything. I mean, yes, we've behaved appallingly in the past and our colonial past and all that. But that's how it was. And yes, we should never do it again. Mm. We keep getting rid of all the signs of it. People will forget.
Yes,
you know,
I agree.
It's like, hang on a minute. We should be remembering and apologising and righting the wrongs, but not ignoring the fact, because that's how it was.
Mm. Now, I heard you on Front Row recently talking about the plight of low pay of young costume designers and the industry generally. And I just wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, because I thought it was, I'd not realised that you pointed out that, you know, sometimes a designer will only get £5,000 if it's a small budget film. And, you know, they get very low pay is what you were saying.
Yes. I mean, I got involved with the Guild. I am a member of the Costume Designers Guild of America. Mm-hmm. I've never been a union person, because when I started, it was like a protection league and it was really hard. And you'd work with, I will say, these terrible men, wardrobe supervisors, whatever they're called, who got their friends in and used to be so rude about young designers. And I just hated the whole protectionist thing. And my father was obviously in the Musicians Union, which also had... But I mean, I think that was probably a better union in a way. And now I think probably unions really have a place. And
what advice would you give to a young budding designer wanting or hoping to work in your industry?
I think these days I would advise them to go to a really good art school like Bournemouth or Wimbledon or Rose Bruford, or I'm sure there are many others. I don't know all. But the great thing is, particularly places like Bournemouth and I think Wimbledon, they make sure they get placements on films. I know a lot of the Bournemouth lot did Harry Potter and, you know, well, so they actually see what it's like on set from a real perspective. And the other thing I would say is learn every skill, i.e. sewing, dyeing, art finishing, fitting, making, in any cutting. You don't have to be brilliant at it, but understand it, because I've quite often had to suddenly re-back a waistcoat at 20 minutes notice, you know, because something's happened, or and I certainly can handle a sewing machine. I'm not great, but I understand it, and I think it's really good, because the other thing is they may find they don't actually like being in the main costume designer and taking the brunt and all that.
Yeah.
Actually, there's some other areas, loads of different areas of costume design that are really fun, and every job is different. So that's the main advice I'd give them.
Okay, I think that's very good advice. Jenny Bevan, thank you very much for sharing your RDI insights. It was great. Thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Mike.